Blog Talk Radio.
Oh, I take what you pay, but I got to put you down for a while. Well, you know I take what you pay, but I got to put you down.
Hello, everybody, and thank you for joining us once more on Knuckles and Gloves Boxing Radio. I'm Patrick Connor of Knuckles and Gloves, the Fight City, Oregonian, a couple other places sometimes, and again, thanks for being here. We appreciate it. In just a minute, my pal Bryn Jonathan Butler will be with us. We're going to be talking a little light heavyweight action, a little actual heavyweight action, and just some all-around ridiculous fun. Probably poking fun at Bobby Chez at some point, just because, I don't know, that's become a tradition on this show. We're assholes. Hello. Nice to meet you guys. And just letting you know. But Bryn will be with us in just a sec. Look, Eleider Alvarez this past weekend scored a pretty massive knockout over Sergey Kovalev. And obviously, we're all boxing fans here. You're probably not tuning in if you've never watched boxing before. We know that Sergey Kovalev was, you know, quote-unquote stopped by Andre Ward not too long ago. So we know that, and I mean in general, I think we know that he's not invincible. But that being said, that was obviously a far different situation than we had this past Saturday. And I think that it pretty much goes without saying, and it's the overall response to what happened was shock. Obviously not on the level of a Buster Douglas, Mike Tyson. That's probably the go-to pinnacle for shock in boxing and whatnot. But it was not really expected, I think. Max Kellerman, I believe, kind of hit the nail on the head on that. I can't remember if it was him or if it was somebody else. Pretty sure it was him. When he said that we could have seen this going a whole number of ways, but Kovalev getting stopped like that was probably like lowest on the list. And it was just kind of an eye opener when that happened. So it gives us new blood at light heavyweight. It gives us kind of new possibilities for where we could go at light heavyweight. And we also have to sit there and wonder what Sergey Kovalev does next, if anything, in boxing. So these are all questions we're going to try to tackle today. And right on cue, Bryn Jonathan Butler. What's up, man?
How you doing, Patrick?
I'm doing all right. It's, you know, it's smoky as shit in Oregon right now because there's fires and it's really hot. But it's okay. I'm living, you know, L-I-V-I-N. How you doing?
I'm good, yeah. I don't know if you were looking at the New York Times on Sunday going over, like, the magazine. The entire issue was allocated towards a 30,000-word article on where the environment is and where it's headed. Oh, no. Those fires are just, like, the tip of the spear of what's going down.
Yeah, I mean, without dragging, you know, politics too much into this, I'm definitely not somebody who denies that there's anything going awry with the environment. It is, and we're accelerating it. There's absolutely zero question about it. I'm also not really much of an optimist about this, and I'm pretty sure that we've done damage that can't be undone and will continue to do so. What that means is, I guess, anybody's guess for the kids and whatnot, but now that we've really thoroughly depressed the shit out of everybody, now we can really depress them with some boxing.
Yeah, I mean, Kovalev is kind of emblematic of the environment falling apart.
Is the environment racist, too?
Well, I mean, you could make an argument that it is, that it's targeting certain groups.
We've delved into the whole Kovalev racism thing before, and I mean, you know, it's kind of unfortunate that that was part of the, you know, I saw a number of people and a number of my friends and too were like, you know, good to see a racist go down like that. And under normal circumstances, like in general, I agree with that sentiment. Like racists going down, yes, good, but it's obviously just a little bit more nuanced than that. Needless to say, Eleider Alvarez probably should be more the story of the weekend than he was. But of course, the story of the weekend was Sergey Kovalev getting knocked out, not so much the guy who did it.
Yeah, absolutely right. And I mean, it was all three of those knockdowns. I was aware Kovalev, who's knocked out almost everybody he's ever fought, is as exciting being knocked out as he is knocking people out. Like, it looked like a promotional video that's going to come for HBO. It's like, because like his eyes roll into his head, like it was just so animated and dramatic, and he gets up every time, and then these just brutal, I think all three of the knockdowns were combination shots that were just perfection in terms of, you know, one setting up the other and just the way he was collapsing and trying to clear his head. Like, it was just so arresting. Like, you know, some people getting knocked out, you just immediately feel sad. And it is always kind of sad to watch these guys get broken down. But with Kovalev, like, I don't know, there was just this added drama about it that some guys have toward the end of their career, and others, it, you know, it peters out, or, you know, Rigondeaux quits against Lomachenko. So it's like, oh, that was the end of his rise. That's the end of his relevance of what he was before. It's like, clearly we've turned a page. Kovalev was just, I mean, everybody that I was watching it with just jumped out of their chairs. And it's like, can he really ever come back from that? Even if he has to fight a few more fights or wants to fight a few more fights, the Kovalev that we knew, this seemed like the end of it. I don't know if I felt quite that with Ward because of all the issues that were attached to that. I thought he won the first fight. The second fight seemed like a lot of low blows, even though I'm not saying that Ward wasn't winning the second fight or wouldn't have won the second fight, but there were asterisks attached to it. This was just a stone-cold beating.
Yeah, there was definitely controversy attached to that Ward rematch. You know, that was, I think that was a big thing, was it was easy to explain away the other things that had happened in Sergey Kovalev's career that were, you know, not according to narrative. He should have won the first Ward fight. I agree, he should have won the first Ward fight. I scored the first fight for him and thought he won it. And then in the second fight, it was controversial because he got nailed with several shots to the penis. But, like, you know, I mean, it was tough. And I admit it, that at the time I was one of the people that was like, it was borderline. And, you know, the way that he was leaning forward, it was kind of exacerbating. But, I mean, Andre Ward hit him in the junk a handful of times there. And it was controversial because of that. And then in his subsequent two fights, I think that it was also easier to explain away, you know, in moments where he wasn't looking great or looked a little bit flat. But Adam Abramowitz of Saturday Night Boxing and a couple other places sometimes, he's a real good dude. One of the things that he's been saying lately, in the last few days since the stoppage, basically, is just, he's kind of been taking to task the people who are saying, see, Kovalev was ruined by Ward, or, you know, he never had it, or he was just mentally, you know, weak and he folded and that was it and it was easy. And his position is more that, look, Eleider Alvarez, like, blasted the guy, and the guy was doing really well at the time. I mean, I think that the truth is maybe just a little bit in between, but at the same time, I lean more toward what Adam's saying, in that, you know, Sergey Kovalev did look good. He was in command of the fight and was doing well. He was landing the heavier shots and the cleaner shots. He seemed to be controlling more of the fight and kind of pulling ahead at that point. And he just got hit with like an errant missile, man. That is literally what happened. But
yeah,
what makes it, you know, just a shade under that, in my opinion, is that we've seen before also that Alvarez can be kind of placid in there. He can be kind of, he can wait way too much. He did it against Jean Pascal, who himself is a guy that just like doesn't punch that much. And so that's a little bit disconcerting, the fact that that was kind of hurting him in this fight until he landed that shot. But I guess it doesn't really matter, because he did land that shot and it totally took Sergey Kovalev's legs away. And yeah, it was definitely just kind of like, whoa, holy shit, where'd that come from?
For a guy, you know, they were going on and on, the HBO commentators. I find the HBO commentating is going a really weird place where, like, even sometimes for 4 or 5 minutes, they're not even talking about the fight anymore. I don't know if you've noticed that, but, like, Tom Hauser, I was watching it with him, and he made that point. I was like, it is a thing that they just start talking about something for almost 2 rounds before they return to the action. And anyway, this one trope that they kept bringing up again and again and again was that Alvarez was fighting with 2 knuckles when he was punching. He had this big issue about not being able to use all 4 of his knuckles when he was punching. I was like, what? I don't even know what that is. I've never heard of that issue being raised about anybody before. I can't think of any fighters where knuckles were a big issue, other than like Felix Sabon. A lot of people have commented that he had like an extra ridge of knuckles behind his front knuckles. It's like a thing with him. Have you ever heard that before about Sabon?
I've heard things like that, yeah. And I've also, you know, heard like kind of wives' tale type of things about various guys' hands from back in the day, especially like in bare knuckle boxing, because, you know, that was extremely rough on the hands. But
sure.
Yeah, I've heard like kind of urban legend type things, yeah.
So I just thought it was odd that Alvarez, who they're making a big point of, that he's no longer puncher, but, you know, I thought he was devastating when he wanted to be. And I agree with everything you said, that I thought Kovalev was in control of the fight. I thought he was way ahead on the scorecards. But, you know, what I was aware of is a couple points with Kovalev. Is I think Kovalev is an example. We've addressed it a lot of times tongue-in-cheek about the prevalence of PED use. Kovalev is what a body looks like at 35 of a professional athlete who probably has never used PEDs.
Yeah, or, I mean, I guess, or perhaps isn't using them anymore or something. But, I mean,
yeah.
I guess I'm just cynical. But, no, but I do agree. He does look like somebody who's in their mid-30s and is, you know, still getting it together and still going to the gym and still working his ass off and stuff like that. But, he's not jacked. He's not like...
And he's never been jacked.
Super vascular. And totally.
No. He's never been jacked. He, you know, he's clearly in shape. He's a professional athlete. He's totally up to the standards that are necessary to maintain at being at an elite level. But guess what? At 35... he doesn't have the same stamina that he did in his late 20s. And you can see it in between rounds. Even though he was ahead on the fight, you could see when he'd get back to the corner, second, third, fourth round, he's breathing differently. That's what happens when you get older and you're not on fucking EPO. Is everything starts wearing down. You can't train the same way that you used to. So I thought that was just something that occurred to me watching him. Is what stood out was he looked as though he was aging the way athletes used to age, where you didn't improve home run performance in your mid-30s over what you were doing in your mid-20s. He just looks like a regular guy where there's erosion and there's wear and tear. His performance, he's not capable of performing at, you know, at 100% the way he used to. And when you fall off a little bit at the elite level, you're more susceptible to get caught by things like he did. He's still, you know, at a championship level, but it's good. There's going to be some firefights there now with him at 35. That's the way it's generally supposed to be, especially in a division as dangerous as light heavyweights. I think you could make a strong argument that's one of the most dangerous divisions to be in terms of the skill level, with the speed, and with the power. Like,
I don't know about you, but if I had to think of a division I would not want to be in, if I happened to be a top 10 fighter, it would be light heavyweight, because I just think there's no room for error, and you've got highly, highly skilled guys who are really fucking fast too. So I don't know. It just seemed like an interesting way to compare. We saw Golovkin and Canelo, like some pictures of them. Their bodies are looking really weird right now. And just, I don't know, just sports in general, all these guys in their mid 30s who get more jacked than they ever were in their 20s. Kovalev does seem like an example of this anomaly from that. He doesn't look like a jacked athlete, just like you saw with soccer players in the World Cup. None of those guys look jacked because it's such a skill-based game. Being a tremendous athlete is not really going to take you to the elite level of soccer because it's so reliant on skill as opposed to athleticism like so many of the other sports. So, I don't know. It was just something that jumped out at me about Kovalev. Was I was like, look at the way he's breathing in the corner. Like, that's the way it used to be. When you think of Ali getting older, Frazier getting older, all those guys. Like, it was a throwback to that to me. We don't see it as much anymore at all.
Well, like the old adage about middleweights used to be that it was such a fun division because, fighters were still fast at 160, 150, 160 pounds, but they were starting to hit a little heavier, I guess, viewing the entirety of all, boxing divisions, I guess. But then you start moving up to light heavyweight at 175 pounds. Like, your average person who's not an athlete that weighs 175 pounds is probably going like 5'6", 5'7". Mm-hmm. But your average, like, fucking light heavyweight who is actually an athlete is probably closer to like 6', 6'1", something like that. And you start to realize that, especially when you see these guys in person, and especially when they're not cutting weight, and you see that they're, a fairly big human being. They're mm-hmm. bigger fighters, and it seems to be a little bit more dangerous in terms of the heft, the punching power. But I mean, since I'm the, history slut here, today is the anniversary of, I posted this a little bit ago on the Boxing History account. It's the anniversary of Bobby Joe Young's win over Aaron Pryor. And it was the only loss in Aaron Pryor's career. But, I mean, the reason why I bring this up is because Aaron Pryor was 31 years old, and he was shizot. Dude was done at 31 years old. And that is more along the lines of what one might expect under normal circumstances for a fighter like Aaron Pryor, that's fighting regularly and fighting from a young age, not fighting to be 46, 47, 48 years old. Some of that obviously was cognitive. A lot of it was drug use. Nonetheless, you just don't really see very many instances where a fighter was lasting well into his late 30s, early 40s in previous eras, even just back into the 80s. And a lot of that is PED usage.
Yeah, because I think boxing is still lagging so far behind the other sports in terms of the way they're training. I mean, it was still revolutionary for Holyfield to shift into using weights. I think Holyfield is one of the biggest steroid users ever in boxing, like the biggest example of that. But he was also just so modern and scientific with his training methods. And still in the U.S., like, I find the Russians and the Cubans, like, all of their trainers were highly educated. Like, you really couldn't be an elite trainer in Cuba without having a PhD. And when I was training with a lot of those guys, everything was measured. And you go into, like, American gyms, top gyms, maybe in the last 20 years, if Wildcard is our biggest gym, it's exactly the way gyms were being operated 50 years ago, with elite fighters and world champions walking in. Like, nothing had really changed much in the training methods. Maybe the diet was improved to a degree, but clearly the factor that's changed, like to address what you're talking about, is PED usage being widespread, altering that these guys can go into their mid-30s and be just as fast and have all the stamina and everything. And then all these bodies that get worked over where, you know, you hear the commentators saying, oh, look at how dialed into training. Look at the physique of this guy at 35. And it's like, he never looked like that in his early 20s. Floyd looked better physically in his late 30s than he did in his early 20s. He had a better build, you know, like he was leaner and bigger. And that just doesn't happen physiologically. Like, I mean, movie stars do it because movie stars are juicing when they do a role. You know, like Edward Norton in 3 months becoming what he did in American History X from what he's looked like the rest of his life before that and after. How does he do it? What are his training methods? Very easy. He's taking drugs. Like Mickey Rourke
HGH,
in The Wrestler. How did he do it?
Testosterone replacement. I mean, come on.
Yeah. How did Mickey Rourke get into that kind of shape at 60 years old for The Wrestler? Very easy. He went on the Sylvester Stallone Rocky IV diet of getting fucking jacked with drugs. And you're telling me that, like, pro athletes where their lives are on the line are not going to do the same thing in boxing? Like, this also brings up the question of why wouldn't Kovalev cheat if everybody else is? And I don't believe that Andre Ward, for example, was taking PEDs. I don't think that body ever changed in a way that, like, to me flags him as somebody that's a likely user, because I saw him when he wasn't training and I was like, he doesn't even look like a professional athlete. And even when he gets into really good shape, he goes from what I saw in between fights that was, I don't know, 14-15% body fat, a guy still training but eating French fries with like a hamburger or having a soda, that kind of thing, to like dialing in his diet and then training 4 or 5 hours a day and all the road work. He doesn't become a hugely jacked guy. He just becomes a leaner version of an athletic person, kind of like Kovalev, like similar thing. He looks athletic. You wouldn't say he looks like a professional athlete the way you would if you were in like a locker room of an NFL team looking at those guys walking around. They're superhuman, right? And boxing didn't used to look like, all the fighters didn't look superhuman until really like the 90s.
Yeah, like I'd say like the late 80s, early 90s was when it really started kicking off. And it's like, you bring up Sylvester Stallone, and it's funny because if you watch Rocky, the first Rocky, and you see Sylvester Stallone, and it's like, he's not a super big guy. You know, he's only
not
like maybe like 5'8". He's like 5'8", mm-hmm, or something like that. And I mean, he's not super big. Like he's fit, but he's not really that muscular, I guess. He looks pretty like normal. Like, I mean, normal, somewhat big, athletic, former wrestler or something like that. And then he goes into like Rocky 2 and 3, and he's like the veiniest son of a bitch this side of the Mississippi, dude. It's totally different. And I think that's along the lines of when you start seeing athletes, you know, looking a little bit different and stuff like that. But as it applies to Sergey Kovalev, in a way, I guess, if that is true, if it is true that he went much of his career or all of his career or whatever, or just never really used PEDs, in a way that puts him at a disadvantage. And I kind of feel bad for the guy, because even with all of the racism stuff, and even though it kind of left a sour taste in everybody's mouth, and I'm kind of with them, he got screwed over because he presided over a division where there actually was a ruler who like ruled over somewhere else and wasn't really interested in taking on challenges, and because of that still is ruling, whereas Sergey Kovalev kind of cleaned out the division for him. And on top of that, was denied a few bigger fights, or a few fights that were, they was, you know, holding out for Adonis Stevenson, and then the whole Andre Ward fiasco, and now this. Like, I just kind of feel bad for the guy, because this is not where I think a lot of people expected him to be, maybe even after the first Andre Ward fight. You know, I think a lot of people expected him to bounce back, and I don't know.
Well, if he was given his legitimate due and won the first Ward fight on the cards, he's in the Hall of Fame. That's it. And now that they took that from him, and then what the result that happened in the second, I don't know what the circumstances would have been in the second fight had he won, how much that would have changed the dynamic. I mean, I don't think Ward is always going to be, you know, impossibly good, impossibly determined, full willpower, but that didn't help him to win, in our view, that first fight. Kovalev solved him. Kovalev dropped him. I thought Kovalev dropped off in the latter half of that fight, but none of those iffy rounds went his way, which seems kind of ridiculous, like not one of them on the judges' scorecards. Now, I think it's sort of iffy, even though the Hall of Fame is a bullshit thing in terms of who they're voting in every year. I think it's become laughable, the standard. Interesting just to think what Kovalev's career looks like if he's given that win in the first fight, and then who knows where the rematch goes, and then, you know, his career just goes a totally different direction. Now everybody's sort of thinking, was he as good as we thought he was? Does he really have the resume that we thought he did? Was he really a killer, or has he been kind of exposed by Ward, those two losses, and now he's been knocked out handily by a guy who's not really known as a big puncher? So it's an interesting career now. Like, if this is it, where do you see him standing as, like, do you see him as a great light heavyweight? Do you think he deserves to be in the Hall of Fame?
Man, it's tough. I mean, I don't want to malign the Hall of Fame institution, even though there have been a lot of decisions that I think are wonky. That's kind of putting it kindly. But I have noticed that in the last few years, especially because I had wanted to become a voter, and especially in this last year because I became a voter and voted, I noticed that, you know, it really doesn't have much to do with deserving. It doesn't have much to do with accomplishment per se, or the weight of accomplishment. It's a lot of it is a popularity contest. But and if I'm looking at this in terms of accomplishments, like, would I vote for him? That's a good question. I guess it would really depend on the ballot, but there's kind of a lack of really good or great fighters on his resume that he defeated when they were in their prime, and that's a problem.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the way that he dominated Bernard Hopkins, even though Bernard Hopkins was as old as he was when he got the win, was impressive, because nobody had done that to Bernard Hopkins even to that point. Like, not quite that way. They didn't beat his ass and win pretty much every round. You know, Chad Dawson was able to kind of nip and tuck his ass over, you know, the distance. But Sergey Kovalev, a lot of it because of Hopkins' age, just, you know, whooped his ass. But beyond that, like, there's two John Pascal fights when Pascal's, you know, clearly past his, you know, use-by date, and it's just kind of thin, so I don't know that I would really vote for him. But I do kind of agree with what you said, though. I think that if he gets that first win in the Ward fight, which I think he should have gotten, and I think that the majority of fans, if not a big majority, but the majority of fans seem to think that he should have deserved, that's a pretty big boost in the right direction, because Andre Ward was a legitimate pound-for-pound, you know, player, undefeated. Yeah, it would have been pretty massive. And then if he would have managed to get that win and then another win in a rematch, again, impressive. But it does kind of beg the question, does that turn of events, you know, does the fact that he lost the first Andre Ward fight, I mean, mean, this is obviously a massive speculation here and nobody knows, but had he won that first Andre Ward fight, would he still be undefeated now? Would he have defeated, you know, would he have gone all the way through until now, or would the path have been the same? Would it have changed much, or was he just mentally weak all along and just would have folded, you know, the entire time? One of the things that I had brought up not long before the fight was that my concern about Sergey Kovalev in the ring was that he fights in a way that he doesn't think he needs to change anything or adjust at almost any time, or at least minimally. He's a much better technician than he seems to be, but he also doesn't seem to be very good at making quick adjustments or changing his style in any way. And I thought that that could be something that, you know, could hurt him in the future, in the sense that he's not very difficult to find. He's somewhat easy to hit sometimes, but that's kind of the debate. The debate is, was he just not good enough all along, or did the Andre Ward loss, you know, bring that out of him or something?
And I mean, my feeling is that he was good enough, and that, you know, he fell off toward the end with age. His activity level diminished a fair bit, like, I mean, a discernible bit. But I mean, he was an incredibly dangerous guy for anybody. I mean, Ward had a lot of problems with him. You know, Ward, it really brought out the best of Ward to eke out that win. You know, like he was losing rounds in the second fight. You know, lots of rounds. I mean, I think he was behind on the scorecards of at least one judge, maybe two judges, if I'm not mistaken, in the second fight. And I mean, that's quite something to take away from Kovalev. Like, you wonder psychologically what it must have done to him to get up for that first Ward fight, to win it. I think in the majority of people who watched that fight agree that he did enough to win. And to have it taken from you and know that, like, this would be your crowning achievement, not just to beat a player in the pound-for-pound ratings, but pretty much the consensus, the face of, the pound-for-pound king he beat. Because I don't know that anybody at that time was saying that Lomachenko had done enough to deserve to be the pound-for-pound king. It was Ward. I mean, it was Ward after Floyd left. And, you know, Kovalev drops him early and then seems to just give him a lot of problems. And really the only reason I thought he deserved to lose the first fight was just his activity fell off. You know, just wasn't throwing enough to sustain the pressure that he had in the early going. And when he was able to sort of assert himself, had enough energy to do it, Ward was losing every one of those rounds. Every one of those rounds, Ward was not able to assert himself. Ward was surviving. And to be able to do that to the pound-for-pound champion, like, that's the kind of stuff that should get you into the Hall of Fame. Like, regardless of the judge's verdict, the performance he put on against Andre Ward at that point, given what Ward's resume is, tells me that he is as good as we thought he was, because nobody's done that to Ward. Show me the other guys who've done that to Ward when they fought. No, there's nothing close to that in all of Ward's career. So I believe he deserves credit for that, but that's just the way this played out, is the judges going against him, and then the rematch happens. And I mean, I even take issue with that he was punched in the dick. Those uppercuts were hitting him at the bottom of his balls. They were so low. So...
that was back in like the 80s and 90s, what we would call the gooch before it was known as the taint.
Yeah, and I just mean, like, even the HBO announcers, like, watching the replay were like, borderline, that's on the belt. I'm like, what belt are you looking at? Like, you're looking at a replay. You're watching a replay of it, like, 3 inches below the line of the bottom of the belt. And, like, clearly it's hitting the bottom of his cup, and he's punching up to do it. Like, they were egregiously low blows. But, you know, that's the way it went, and loses his second, and then has a couple tune-ups and steps into this where he's winning. But, again, looking really tired in between the rounds, and
you know, it's a dangerous, dangerous place to be, to look as fatigued as he did, even though he's ahead on the scorecards, as he was against Ward in both of their fights, and stuff like this can happen. So I think it'd be kind of a shame to write him off or I don't think it's legitimate to call into question how good he was. He was a very, very formidable champion. And but that's part of what makes boxing so interesting, is this kind of stuff can happen, fair or unfair,
right,
and it can come to define you. Like, and there are a lot of other fighters where that's true of their legacy as well.
Well, it sounds like just kind of rumors the last day or so are that Sergey Kovalev is going to try and press for an immediate rematch, which I think is probably a mistake. But regardless, you know, I would respect that. Obviously, that's ballsy. You know, he got the tar beat out of him in the span of about 35 seconds. And yeah, I think that if there's any question or any doubt in terms of his fortitude or in terms of what he has mentally, that would answer it. But, I mean, he's 35. I would imagine that it sounds like Alvarez wants to fight again this year, at least by December. I don't know if Kovalev would be ready for that or want to do that. And if he weren't, then it would be in 2019. He would be closing in on 36 years old. And I think that also something that we saw both in Golovkin and Kovalev, and they were often being compared when they had just kind of burst onto the U.S. scene, partially for this reason too, obviously because they're both knocking dudes out, but they were both also fighting often. They were both fighting 3 to 4 times a year. And then as they obviously got bigger, it went to like 1 to 2 times a year. Always a shame, in my opinion, and it keeps guys out of the ring,
me
keeps
too.
Them less sharp, and it just kind of allows them that opportunity to get out of shape or whatever. But and that's also one of the things that Kovalev had said from the hospital on his Instagram account, that he felt that his training camp was too long. Obviously, this is a dude sitting in the hospital who just probably got concussed, but you know, he might not be saying all of the things that he should be saying or truthful, but regardless, yeah, it's difficult to see him coming back in this situation successfully, but if he were, that would be pretty big. To kind of shift the focus also back to Alvarez, I can't remember who it was on the broadcast, but one thing that at least somebody on the HBO crew said that I thought was really good and I agreed with was I can't remember who it was, but they said that it was a lot of what was going on in there and a lot of the success that Alvarez was having kind of, you know, between the cracks a little bit. It seemed as though Kovalev was winning rounds and perhaps dominating on scorecards or could be pulling away on the scorecards, but some of the rounds were a lot closer than that sounded. And the reason for that was because Alvarez was very his speed and his, like, the snap in his punches were surprising Kovalev. It wasn't so much that he was hurting him at any time. He seemed to kind of stun him once or twice, but it was that difference in speed and the difference in kind of explosiveness that was really making Kovalev tentative and having him, you know, not really engaging quite as much as he normally would, or not attacking quite as much as he normally would. And, you know, I kind of opened up saying something about this, but we've seen Eliodir Alvarez before just be kind of passive in the ring. And it seems to be, for whatever reason, kind of part of his style, which is just, I hate that. I just really hate that in a fighter, because it's just a waste.
Yeah.
It's a waste of time. It's a waste of energy. It's, you know, wasted opportunities for hitting the dude who's in the ring with you. I know that it takes energy, and I know that you don't want to, you know, burn yourself out, but this, I guess, is part of the reason why a lot of us love the fighter who is willing to go out on his shield or burn himself out trying, rather than saving all of his energy for one last 20-second flurry in round 12 that's wholly unsuccessful, you know, but nonetheless, he wound up pulling it out of his ass with a pretty massive right hand.
No, he did, and it was interesting.
Again, it was one that Kovalev just didn't see coming.
No, you're absolutely right, and it was interesting to see that, you know, just what you're talking about, the fight that preceded it, like Bivol, where you had the HBO people just gushing over him, and he's obviously a very talented guy, and everything was being geared toward him squaring off against Kovalev if Kovalev could get past Alvarez. And I thought it was a pretty lackluster performance on the part of Bivol, and not because he doesn't show his ability, but just there was that unwillingness, just like you're describing, of sort of putting his foot on the gas and dispensing with somebody who's in front of him, who's really just there, has just been hired to make Bivol look good. And it was a long – I mean, that was a boring, boring fight to watch after maybe the second round. And just completely on Bivol, that there was just an unwillingness to apply himself, to take any risks and really dispense with who was in front of him, despite him having an incredible skill set. I mean, that guy's a really fun guy to watch when he wants to put on a show, but he just wasn't interested, it seemed like. And you just wonder how a guy can function that way when you have, like, the canvas of HBO and that kind of audience to, you know, display your wares and become a blue-chip stock for a lot of people who've never seen you before. This is their first impression of you. And I thought the first round you were agreeing with the HBO commentators, and almost every round after that I was thinking, just shut up. Like this is not a good performance. This is really boring, and it just feels like it feels like publicity as opposed to commentating. So yeah, and Kovalev was somebody earlier on where you expected him to go in there and put people away. He seemed to enjoy it. There was a meanness and almost like a cavalier menace about him that made him so special early on. But it seemed like as he got older, it was harder to apply the pressure. And he was much more aware of his fitness level so that he was more careful. And it's understandable, but it makes you appreciate the guys that are willing to do that or are capable of doing that. And I wonder with Bivol, I mean, we haven't talked about it yet, but I wonder what you thought of his performance.
Well, I think that a guy that I kind of liken him to, or he reminds me of, in not so much in style, but in terms of reputation and in terms of expectation, is Artur Beterbiev. In the sense that, you know, he's a light heavyweight and he has a lofty kind of amateur background, and so high expectations because of that, and, you know, potentially matched with Kovalev or somebody along those lines for a big leap into the light heavyweight division. And I think that Beterbiev in general probably was a little bit more explosive and showed a little bit better promise, but they both at times just showed a propensity for kind of just one, maybe a gear and a half, like just not really having much of a gas pedal at times. And that's something that we've seen with Dmitry Bivol in his last two fights. First against Sullivan Barrera, where he dominated and he did very well. He looked, he looked dominant against a guy that it's not easy to look dominant against. And then wound up just kind of exploding out of nowhere in the 12th round and getting the stoppage, which was great. But there weren't very many moments in the preceding 11 and a half rounds where he really pressed forward. And then that was kind of the case against Isaac Chalemba, who, I mean, again, it's worth noting that Chalemba is a very difficult guy to look good against. He's skilled, he's awkward, he's very experienced. And he hits just hard enough that, you know, it's a good deterrent, but it was still just kind of I don't want to call it a flat performance per se, because he dominated a guy again that's tough to dominate, but there wasn't much of a spark. It wasn't really that impressive. It wasn't really something where you're like, damn it, now I need to see this guy against the guy who knocked out the dude in the main event. That's who I need to see. I mean, it's a good idea, but nobody's really like, I need to see that shit. And that's what he needed to do. He needed to have a more explosive performance. And then if we had seen an explosive performance from him, and then all of a sudden you see Alvarez kicking the shit out of Sergey Kovalev in the main event, it's like, well, that's unnatural. These dudes have to fight now. But now it's kind of like, well, damn, Kovalev got knocked out. And that's pretty much it.
What did you, just to turn the page a little bit, what did you think about Kid Chocolate's performance?
You know what? I honestly didn't see it. I heard about it, but I didn't see it. I followed the tweets as it was happening. So pretty much what people were tweeting about it is all I really know. Overall, discarding that and just, you know, going forward knowing that I haven't seen the fight, it sounds to me like Peter Quillen is not really going to have a super easy time on the comeback trail. It sounds like there's a question of whether or not his heart's in it, first of all, from interviews that I read leading up, but also just kind of, you know, physically, whether or not he's up for it. I don't know. What are you coming away with it with?
No, that it was flat. It was very uninspired. I think he's just in it for a paycheck. I mean, I always liked Kid Chocolate. I always liked his. He had a style where you were kind of scared for him, and then he'd pull off big victories. I mean, it wasn't like Gaddy, in the sense that Gaddy would be on the brink of being knocked out, or like you think like he'd get hit with a heavy shot, and you'd be like, if the guy lands another one or two, he's in real trouble. That would happen to Peter. You'd go to fights of his, and he'd get caught with something, and you'd be like, oh, my God, he's about to lose for the first time, and then he'd come back and just tear the guy's head off. It was a very exciting dynamic that he would respond to adversity with a bold response. Like, you take more risk after something shitty had happened to him. So I was a big fan of that. It made for really exciting fights. But I always thought he was a pretty protected fighter. I thought luck played too much of a role in his success. To be fair, I think to be lucky, you have to be close. He deserves credit for being close, for working hard, overcoming a lot of really shitty circumstances in his life. But I always just thought once he steps in there with a quality opponent, I think he's done. And the Jacobs performance was terrible. Maybe an early stoppage, but I just thought, Jesus, like this is not a good look that you get, you know, what is it? I still feel weird saying on Queer Street. It feels like kind of a homophobic thing. What are you saying about on Queer Street? But it is a fair summation of what happened to him after getting caught.
Well, I mean, I don't want to get too fucking nerdy here, but, you know, back in the day, obviously, the words gay and queer meant different things than they do now. So to say on Queer Street or to call something queer was to say it was strange. And unfortunately, because of that, it evolved into, you know, describing someone who is homosexual. But nonetheless, the term was, at least it seemed to be invented at a time where it meant nothing in terms of, you know, homosexual connotation. But I suppose I could be wrong on that. Of course, now it's just kind of an awkward thing to say. There are far more things to say. I mean, you got Mauro Ranallo with the, you know, hit him with the peninsula south of the equator, you know, that type of shit. I mean, you got to give it to him. He's at least creative.
He is, yeah, he scares me. I like him. He's a nice person, and I've dealt with him, and he's, I just, like, when he's doing his commentary, it really makes me feel strange. Like, I feel like there's something perverse about me watching what I'm watching that he is commentating on it. Like, I don't know. He's a very interesting individual. Like, a white person saying that somebody's on fuego, that shouldn't happen. Somebody should inform him, don't do that. Bad idea.
Yeah, there are a handful of things that are kind of on the level of Gus Johnson's nuts and guts. But for the most part, I think that he's pretty, he's pretty like harmless and not, for me at least, not difficult to listen to. And I've also mentioned before, I have a bit of a soft spot for Pride Fighting Championships from back in the day, of which he was a part and a commentator. So I kind of like him, and I know I'm kind of in the minority on that one, but he does have some moments where I'm like, ah, dude, really dial it back. And that's coming from somebody who, you know, has been called like, you know, announcery and with my voice. So I get it. I gotcha.
It's just when it feels like you've been working, like you spent the weekend coming up with 10 phrases that you're waiting to use to bring attention to yourself as an announcer, that I just feel embarrassed. That's all it is. Like, I think he's a nice guy. I think he's totally a good-spirited person towards everybody, and I've never heard a bad thing about how he's dealt with anybody. But it just feels ridiculous in a way that – and I mean, I say this. I grew up with WWF wrestling, where I didn't know that Vince McMahon was the owner of wrestling. I thought he was an announcer. I thought he was my favorite announcer to listen to, or, you know, Gorilla Monsoon or Jesse Ventura. I loved those guys. I thought they were tremendous announcers, no matter how outlandish it got. It was so much fun. But it brought me more into what I was watching. And I find he takes me out of whatever I'm watching, where I'm thinking, like, why are you saying that? That's all it is. I'm just always like, why are you saying, like, I don't feel like you're really present. I just feel like you're trying to put, you know, it's like looking at a photograph and somebody has used one of those Facebook effects to like do something to it. And you're just like, I just wish that shit wasn't all over it. Like, it's like shitty graffiti on something that's art or something. I don't know. I have weird feelings about his work, but I have no weird feelings about him. He seems like a great guy, but I can't get into fights when I'm listening to him talk. I don't know. Maybe it's a shitty thing to say, but I can't.
You're not alone. You're honestly not. And so it's like one of those things that I'm not going to argue, because I know that I know what the general consensus is, and I understand, like, totally. It's kind of like me. It's like being a boxing fan. It's like, you know, you understand why other people don't like it, because a part of you loathes that shit too. As much as you love it, this shit is fucking awful sometimes. And so you totally, yep. Like, you totally get why when somebody's like, what, boxing? Like with gloves, boxing? And you're like, yeah, you know, I'm going home to watch boxing or something like that. And they're like, that shit's still on? You get it. You understand. You know,
that's a good point.
It's like me. I love metal. Like, I'm a massive metal fan, and I listen to some nasty-ass metal. I don't bother trying to put that shit on at work or trying to make other people listen to it, because I know that they are going to hate it, and I totally understand. But nonetheless.
Well, and I think it's a thin line also, because, like, when I was watching this HBO fight, they had the new intro to the show. Did you notice that? Like, they had
yeah.
They had Jones walking in, and it was Jones, and then they had like the weird, almost video game animation of like behind Tyson walking to the ring, and then a like Holyfield animation video game, Holyfield. I think they had a couple others too. They were like moving you through the decades of who HBO has followed, great fighters and their careers or whatever. And it was bad. Like, it was hokey and embarrassing. And it was embarrassing to see Michael Buffer in the ring the way they did it. Like, it just didn't work, because you could feel that Jim Lampley was crying the first time he watched a rough cut of this being assembled. It was just too nostalgic. And yet I was thinking, they went back to the original theme music that everybody loved. Now, that theme music is way over the top. It's ridiculous, but it's what we remember from watching 80s HBO fights. And I always got shivers listening to it, and total non-boxing fans would sing that music. It was like the greatest music to accompany sports of all sports. It was better than Monday Night Football kind of music to make you feel good if you're in the mood for that. It's gravy on top of something you really want to eat. And HBO was able to do that. And then all of a sudden it was like hyper metal music of the same theme song and watching a truck transporting
HBO film equipment to an event. I'm thinking, who came up with this? Like, clearly an executive was having a conversation with one of the gaffers, and the gaffer's like, you know the most exciting thing about HBO? It's what I do. It's delivering and packing up the shit and unpacking the shit.
Yeah,
you need to play that up.
For people like you and I, who have covered fights and have probably stayed maybe a little too long in press row, writing your shit, like trying to get that write-up in because you're on a deadline and you're like, fuck, all right, click, 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 okay, all right, I'm going, give me like 2 minutes, all right? Like, stop carrying shit over my head. If you've ever been one of those guys, like, yeah, I guess maybe it's a little exciting when you're like pounding away on your fucking laptop trying to get that story in. Otherwise, no, nobody really cares.
And do you know?
Go ahead.
No, sorry to interrupt, but just, do you know who it's not exciting for? The writer trying to get a deadline story about a big fight? Everybody else except that writer. Nobody gives a fuck. Nobody gives a fuck about you leaning over your laptop with free food and a free ticket when you're 15 feet away from the action. Cares about the drama of you made that deadline, Dan Raphael. Oh my God, why isn't there a documentary about all those deadlines you filed? All the travel you've done for free and dispensed food. Nobody gives a fuck about it. Like, you're doing a job, it's a good job, you're well compensated, but don't pretend like it's exciting. Like, I don't want to see an HBO entry theme song serenading Dan Raphael from Virginia to the airport into JFK. He takes an Uber. He gets into Madison Square Garden.
Yeah.
Goes to the concession stand. I don't need to see that. I don't need to see you get credentials.
You know, generally speaking, the whole chronicling the travels type of thing, like in boxing, it's just not. It doesn't really interest me usually. There are some exceptions, but generally, yeah, that's just not really something that, like, I want to watch the fights and I want to hear about the history of the fights and things behind them. Like, and that's not really, that doesn't include production for the most part. I don't really have much of an interest in that, but this is actually something you and I have talked about before with the fight game, because to me, and first of all, this is something that, you know, Lampley was harping about a couple of times on the telecast, the return of the fight game, this blah, blah, blah.
Can't wait.
I don't understand. It's like every like 2 months or something, and then it'll like not be on for like 4 months. So I don't know why it's a return, or it reeks of something that it's like decision making from people who are really out of touch with what consumers actually want right now. And that is exactly why, like, look, if you go to any like boxing schedule or whatever, this coming Saturday, the only fight that I know of that's on is on Facebook. That is what people want. That is the direction that things are going with or without boxing. So boxing can either get its shit together and catch up, or it will be stuck in, like, you know, these archaic, network bullshit contract fighter, you know, house fighter type things. You know, even organizations like Premier Boxing Champions has lately been kind of opening up and working with other bigger promoters to expand the possibilities of matchups and things like that. Whereas HBO, partially because of its inactivity in the world of boxing, but also because of just the way that it's set up, I believe, is still doing this thing where its fighters are its fighters and that's it. And there's no, you know, getting around it. And these guys are fighting on HBO. They're locked in on contract. And that's not a unique thing to HBO. It's just that HBO is the one that is not moving along technologically. Showtime has greatly increased the way that it deals with this on social media. It's also gone to, pairing up along with CBS, to put things on more on the freer network side, to stream things, to kind of innovate a little bit when it comes to. And look, I've been very critical of PBC in the past, so I'm not trying to, you know, cup their balls too much here. But regardless, they have been more or innovative technologically, HBO is pretty much digging its heels in and just refusing to advance. And that's not going to get them anywhere. And now I think that we're seeing, you know, I think that we're seeing kind of a product of that. There's more on the schedule than there was, you know, a month ago, but it's still pretty thin, especially when you look at what HBO used to be in boxing in the past. They're just kind of lagging behind in terms of this kind of decision making, and this whole production thing that we're talking about is just, I think, a symptom of that. That we're seeing people making decisions that are just kind of out of touch with how the sport is developing and also how the world is developing.
I think that's all true. And I think that, you know, they're sticking to this nostalgic thing of, like, as they say, a theme song that for people in their 30s, like a little older than millennials, are like, oh, wow, that was the great music that I would hear before I'd watch a fight with my dad and didn't really understand boxing before somebody showed it to me and that kind of thing. So they're tapping into it. But it's like, what great innovations has HBO come up with in the last 20 years that stand out to you over any of its competitors? I can't think of one in the last 20 years. Like, the last thing they did that was really smart, and of course they abandoned it, was Legendary Nights. People who didn't give a shit about boxing, general sports fans talk about that all the time.
In fairness, 24/7, there were, you know, especially at the start. But it drops off pretty quick after that, because the face off thing, first of all, wasn't a super unique idea. It was, you know, they've been having face to face pre-fight interviews and production interviews for fucking decades. But that it also wasn't very good. Legendary Nights was just absolutely incredible, and I wish they would do more of that. Everybody wishes they would do more of that.
Well, and you're absolutely right. 24/7, especially at the beginning, before Mayweather turned it into its own infomercial, I think before they understood that it was just an infomercial, it was colorful, it was interesting. I was not a Miguel Cotto fan until I watched him talk about his dad, and then I was like, I can't not be a fan of this guy. It showed me a totally different side of him that I hadn't seen. I was like, I don't give a shit if he's taciturn. I don't give a shit that he's reticent to talk to the media, or he just seems closed off or weird in a way that's not appealing. I like that he's private now, because I know how sensitive he is relating to his family, the connection he had, like, between his parents, the mother talking about the loss of that dad. I was just like, I'm totally sold on this guy, and it doesn't feel to me like it was just commerce, like just some commodification of family tragedy. It felt genuine. It felt genuine, and even his inability to articulate it to the camera, like, he just was, you could see him just so uncomfortable talking to cameras. I just went, wow, I love this guy. I don't know how I didn't see this before throughout his career. I was disappointed with Miguel Cotto being like the next iteration of a great Puerto Rican fighter after Trinidad. I was like, no, all I'm thinking about is that I miss Trinidad. And suddenly, no, I appreciate how he's different than Trinidad. And it's cool, too, that he's got his own stuff. And then you see, like, the Andre Ward version of that is sort of what you and I have talked about, which is he'll do an article about all family tragedy because he hasn't tapped into that, I think, to commodify it. And when he's talking to me about it, there's no emotion. It's purely a strategic thing, as far as I'm concerned. And then when HBO cameras are there and Jim Rampley asks about it, he breaks down crying. So I'm just like, ugh, this is awful. And I felt like what Mayweather was doing, the song and dance with his dad and a lot of that stuff, it was all just marketing. Pacquiao's too, like I don't think it's all about Pacquiao, but it turned into something quite different from what its original effect was on people, where it became boring. It became very, you really didn't need to watch it. And you raised the fight game. I have no idea. I mean, it's funny, like, you and I, as people that are pitching stories places to try to make it happen, how do you pitch the fight game on the strength of that idea? What is the utility of having something where basically in 2018, let's preview the most recent fight. Let's go back to Sugar Ray Leonard's rematch against it's so out of date that it has absolutely no relevance to anything that's going on in social media. So purely it's like an ego thing for Lampley, and Lampley has enough swing to bring in people that are, you know, associated by Nick Kahn, like his business manager. So they all get to go in and get, cash their checks. But as far as the boxing audience is concerned, like, it has no relevance. It has no traction with people because it's pointless. And it's just funny that HBO would sign off on something like that. You know, like, there's not somebody to say, this is not going to get any viewers. It looks bad. It's just awkward. There's just stuff like that I don't understand. I mean, they were talking where I was watching the fight about that HBO just re-signed Bill Simmons. And I was kind of like, did you watch his show? What are these great Andre the Giant was really cool. What else is he doing there? How are people like this swallowing up all the money where you could have new people, new ideas, new projects? It just doesn't seem like HBO has those new ideas or bringing people in that are revitalizing it. It's just older people, established
institutions.
It's institutions. Jon Stewart has a new contract with HBO. That was like 2 years ago. Do you remember those great things that have come from that contract? Because I don't, because there hasn't been anything. It's a big name, it makes headlines, and it goes nowhere. Because there's clearly, like, no ideas worth developing that are coming from Jon Stewart.
Well, I mean, it's like you said, a lot of these bigger names and kind of celebrities eating up a lot of budget and whatnot. I mean, look, HBO can allocate however much they want of their budget to whatever it is they're doing. And in terms of worth, in terms of what they're doing, I love their original programming, and a lot of their shows are some of the best, or some of my favorite shows ever. You know, honestly, they're just really, really great. I obviously understand if they're gonna invest far more money into that kind of programming than they are boxing, for instance. I get it. Believe me, in 2018, the return on, Game of Thrones versus the return on boxing, I get it. Okay, but even so, that doesn't mean that you should treat the boxing part as if it's just some lame ass afterthought. It's like sabotaging it from the beginning, where you're investing in. I mean, look, Jim Lampley has done a lot of work in boxing, and he's, I don't want to sound like an asshole here, but he's earned his keep and whatnot. And, you know, I do like Max Kellerman a lot of the time. I hate his interviewing, but I do like Max Kellerman, and I know he loves boxing. But these guys are getting paid a lot of freaking money. And when I know that and I hear things like HBO didn't pick up X, Y, or Z fight, or isn't, you know, kind of behind this fighter or that fighter because of lack of money in their budget, I'm just like, well, can't you, not to be all, you know, mega communist here, but can't you see that this is literally just the representation of capitalism here, where these few guys are getting a shitload of money, but then these other guys who the sport is actually based around can't get money and can't get paid and can't get opportunities because of the other shit? Like, it's kind of evident here. It's pretty obvious, yet nobody seems to have much of a problem with it. And when people speak out about it, it's, you know, you're a-hole guy, you're bad guy. But it there does need to be some examination of that.
I just think also, you know, Legendary Nights is a great thing, again, to look back when boxing was important, when boxing was relevant. That's all cool. Here's a novel idea. Find a young fighter that was inspired by an old fighter and combine a 24/7 sort of like following a new fighter with the older fighter, bring him in to talk about and stuff. And guess what? Boxing fans get to contextualize that new fighter with an old fighter that they know. Woo! Like, is it that hard a promotional tool to, like, give us some names that, like, even before we really get who they are, help us a little bit? Like, spoon-feed us with some people that inspire them. Connect us to their story. Show us the overlap of narratives that are there. It's not hard. It's really, really not hard, and it just – yeah.
And historically, there's a lot of basis for that, too, because, you know, in, like – the 30s, for instance, Jack Dempsey seemed to kind of pick sides or get behind a lot of fighters, you know, heavyweight or not, in terms of kind of endorsing them and putting their name out there. I have absolutely no idea if he was getting paid to do so or if he was doing it on his own accord, but regardless, that's how it pretty much worked. And it was the same after Rocky Marciano retired, where when Floyd Patterson and Archie Moore were kind of battling for supremacy there, he was, seemed to kind of get behind a number of fighters and blah, blah, blah. So there's historical basis for what you're saying, and it makes sense too. And it's just a lack of like really seeing much for what develops an interest in these fighters, and not just trying to look for some ready-made cookie cutter story that they can just insert into HBO. Like it doesn't always work very well that way.
No, I totally agree. It's a failure of imagination. And I mean, I remember as a little kid, before I understood boxing, when my brothers were talking about Mike Tyson, basically when Mike Tyson's Punch-Out came out, I was like, who is the real guy behind this video game? And that was the first time I heard what Tyson's story was. And the way everybody framed it was a result of the way Tyson's promoters and managers were framing his story, which is before he'd done anything, fought anybody, done anything meaningful in terms of accomplishment, on the strength of him knocking everybody out in the first round, there was a poster that said, your grandfather missed Marciano, your dad missed Ali, don't miss Mike Tyson. That's all you have to fucking say, right? Like, we know exactly what that means. You've just aligned three generations.
And even if you disagree, even if you see something like that and you're like, who's this Mike Tyson? All right, now I got to see this just so I can ridicule it. It doesn't matter because they're still buying the ticket.
Exactly. Because whether or not it's true to make such an audacious statement, I want to see, can you live up to that? Because if you don't deliver something that inspires that kind of reaction, I'm never going to see this guy again. But guess what? If you do deliver on that, I'm going to be so – like, you've just given away some crack cocaine to a kid, and they're trying, like, what is that? They're hooked. They're hooked for life. And that's what they did with Tyson. And how did they do that? They did it by managing his career, by giving fans exactly what they wanted, which was fucking first-round knockouts. Did anybody care that those people he was fighting they'd never heard of or had these horrible careers? No, they were just like, this is amazing. Can he just keep doing this? Can he just fight, move into the top 10 and just bowl over everybody? I don't know. And guess what? He didn't do that once he really broke into the top 10. He struggled with a lot of guys that were not big-name people, especially if they were tall and could jab. But it didn't matter because we were so taken with the greatest knockout highlight film probably that there's ever been. You know, like, we just never seen anybody do the things that he was doing. And – you know, even Joe Lewis with the bum of the month club or all that, like, those are, it built up this ability to capture the imagination. And I don't feel like boxing is doing a very good job of doing that with anybody that it's promoting right now. None of these guys capture the imagination anymore. You know, even if their ability is commensurate with guys in the past who did, it's like they just don't know how to do it other than by some paint by number, very corporate, very like groupthink way of managing and stage managing everything. And it's boring. I mean, it's one of the things I liked about wrestling when I was still watching it as like a little kid was if Vince McMahon was packaging somebody as a villain, but fans just tended to really like them anyway, he'd be like, fuck it. Let's go. If Stone Cold Steve Austin isn't hated, people just really like that he's saying fuck you to everybody. Let's celebrate fuck you and turn that into a good guy or an anti-hero. Let's just roll with it and see where it goes. And I'll become his adversary. I'll become the ultimate heel. He can just say fuck you to me and body slam me. I love that willingness to be open to the unexpected. And I feel like boxing is really, really bad at that. You know, like it's just not good at selling itself. Cause like we have the best product of I think any sport when it's really good, and yet we just so get in our own way of putting it together. Like the ingredients are there. It's just like we don't have a guy to fucking like a chef. We just have a shitty chef, but we have the best ingredients. So it's doubly frustrating.
Yeah, it's tough, and it's that's why I said earlier. It's often not easy to even be a boxing fan. But one of the pieces of news, since we were just talking about heavyweights before we get out of here, one of the things I said I wanted to kind of mention earlier too was the idea that Deontay Wilder and Tyson Fury right now are apparently in negotiations for fighting. So Tyson Fury is not this coming weekend, but the following weekend, fighting on the undercard of Carl Frampton versus Luke Jackson in Northern Ireland. And he's fighting Francesco Pianetta. Somewhat of a familiar name for a number of people, but mostly is just kind of an opponent level, type of guy, which is the right level for Tyson Fury right now. But assuming he wins and assuming he looks all right, I guess it sounds like there are negotiations for Tyson Fury to fight Deontay Wilder. So that's something.
Wilder's going to knock him out in 2 rounds. I mean, I thought Fury looked god awful last time, and I mean, it should still happen. I mean, he's undefeated, and stuff was derailed because of mental illness or whatever. So fair enough, but that fight is going to be just a clown show, don't you think? I just think it's ridiculous.
Well, I mean, this will probably sound far more dickish than I mean it, but nonetheless, I'll say it. Any sort of sympathy for Tyson Fury's situation or former situation, his plight, current plight, future plight, whatever you want to say, in terms of mental illness, drug use, and recovering from that, assuming he actually is recovering and not relapsing now and then, whatever sympathy you may have for that situation, however much you might relate to it, admire it, that doesn't add up to shit in the ring. That doesn't mean anything. The fact of the matter is he looked pretty awful against the last dude he fought. I don't know
horrible.
If that fight was even, I don't know if that fight was even on the up and up like at all. I mean, it just looked weird. I mean, there were real punches thrown, so I don't want to, say like that, but it was really weird. A lot of jawing, a lot of like dancing around, a lot of, fucking about and that type of stuff in a fight is just, I don't really have much use for it. I'm not interested in it unless it's, done in a style like an Emmanuel Augustus type way where he's, winning or making it stylish and not just kind of seeming like he's out of his element. And so because of that, he's responding by trying to make it funny. I don't have much use for that. So I'm hoping that if Tyson Fury, actually looks better against Pianetta, and Francesco Pianetta is a guy that he should be able to at least look a little bit better against. I mean, I'm hoping just for the sake of, the heavyweight division being potentially more exciting and having better fighters in it. Francesco Pianetta is a guy that he probably should look somewhat good against. I mean, assuming that he's, in decent shape and up for this. If not, I think that there's, a real good chance that Deontay Wilder just crushes the shit out of him.
Yeah. I mean, and I don't think Deontay Wilder is, the second coming of George Foreman. I mean, he's a dangerous guy. He hits really hard, but he's embarrassing to watch. But I mean, all this is to me is Fury has a big name. He would sell out a Wembley fighting Wilder. If it's in the UK, it's worth a lot of money, but in terms of its actual value to boxing, it's just a sideshow. So, I mean, I don't heartily object to it. Like, that's okay that there's a sideshow every now and again, but taking it seriously as if, as you say, like Fury is off his rocker. He looked in horrible condition, even though he lost 100 pounds or whatever to get into shape for the fight. But I think he's old for his age. There's a lot of wear and tear. He's unhinged. He's pretty revolting when he opens his mouth to discuss just about anything. So I just feel like let's get on with it and get Wilder and Joshua in there. That's the fight everybody wants. That's a fight that's of value.
Yeah.
They're both undefeated. It's going to make a pile of money. Fuck Fury. Good for you. You lost 100 pounds and on the strength of being undefeated and winning against Klitschko, you want a payday. But I almost just feel like somebody should just give him some kind of wage to just leave boxing alone and we can just move on.
Well, you're obviously taking a more hardline stance than I am, but I mean, my feeling on it is pretty much Tyson Fury's there. If we were being ideal here in terms of what would be best for boxing, what would be best for Tyson Fury, he would probably take, I don't know, 2 to 4 more fights before facing somebody like a Deontay Wilder. And it would have to obviously be a fairly steady progression in terms of him looking impressive or, you know, looking as though he has recaptured some of his previous form. However, we also have to keep in mind that his previous form got the crap knocked out of him by Steve Cunningham on national television. You know, he got up to win and it was, I don't know, kind of a semi-dirty knockout, but still he got it. But nonetheless, you know, what is that present or that previous form anyway is a decent question worth asking. And then whether or not he's even able to get to that is, I don't think anybody is wrong to be skeptical or doubtful that that's a possibility. So, yeah, like I said, best case scenario, he takes a few more fights before a Deontay Wilder type of challenge. It doesn't sound like that would be happening. So... Yeah. Does it kind of feel circusy to me? A little bit, yes, because they're obviously banking on Fury's, you know, popularity and his ability to draw in the UK, much more so than him being deserving, like I'd kind of mentioned before. But regardless, it could be a bad idea. Deontay Wilder is just, you know, raw or kind of underdeveloped enough that. Fury putting it all together for, I guess, 10 to 12 rounds is not inconceivable. It's not impossible, but I think it would take a little bit of doing, and I would doubt it.
What I would do here is maybe we don't pay Fury step-aside money. Maybe what we do is offer him a fight against the former light heavyweight, cruiserweight, champion, Bobby Chappie,
yep.
Gentleman, Chez,
yep.
So that, you know, we're atoning for the times that we've disparaged our favorite cereal drinking driver with the men's IQ. Chez comes out of retirement. It gives him something to inspire him to get back into shape. It's not a very dangerous fight against Fury because we know Fury is grossly overweight still, even when he's in the best shape he can be in to fight. Probably going to sell out Wembley Stadium, the two of them. I mean, am I wrong? Like, I mean, at least it's going to get like 2/3 of Wembley up for that fight.
I mean, I'm going to have to go ahead and say that, you know, Bobby Chez, the light heavyweight James Fenimore Cooper, the light heavyweight Louis Moreau Gottschalk, the, you know, super middleweight James Fenimore Cooper, maybe. I don't know. I'm still working it out. We're trying to figure out some sort of – we're working together. But I'm thinking that if he could make a comeback, that maybe they could get the supermarket that he's working at to sponsor, co-sponsor the event or something like that.
100%.
You know, every time he takes a combination, somebody gets a free turkey. I don't know. Red light specials all over. There's possibilities here, man.
Well, we can have a talk with the New Jersey Polish Boxing Hall of Fame, where he's, I think, the star member. I think that's fair to say. I don't think I'm disparaging any of the other proud alumni of that society. But, I mean, what I'm waiting for is in this corner, who made his debut in 1980. He's now in his 38th or 39th year, if it happens next year. His 39th year of being a professional boxer with a record of 44-8. The matinee idol, Chappie, Bobby Chez. I want to hear an English
Chappie,
announcer.
Chappie, Chappie, Chappie. Bob.
Yeah, Chappie. And I,
Chaz.
Yeah, we can hear that after Sweet Caroline. Right? I mean, I don't think Bobby has fought over in the UK. Yeah. I think this is good
would
for
be
everybody.
Pretty, it probably is. It's win-win-win all around.
And yeah, and then Wilder doesn't have to waste time with Fury. Chez has a legitimate chance at becoming, at the age of, like, well, how old is he? So, yeah, I mean, he's 56. So at 56 years old, Chez becomes the oldest linear heavyweight champion in history. He gets to go off in the sunset with that title. You and I get to feel better about ourselves for having disparaged him publicly on numerous occasions. And
right.
Wilder and Joshua get on with it and have a fight at like the beginning, let's say September 2018, next month, Halloween.
Yeah, I mean, it's just got success written all over it, and that's what I'm praying for, really.
I mean, it's like a Rocky that you can feel even better about.
Right. And what I'm really banking on is that by now people have just stopped listening to the episode, so I don't really have to field any shameful, you know, questions about what we're saying. But we'll see.
All right.
Oh, God, we're sick. All right, man. We'll talk to you later. Everybody, thanks so much for tuning in today. We appreciate it. We'll definitely be back soon. And in the meantime, follow Bryn on Twitter at Brynicio, B-R-I-N-I-C-I-O. Follow me, Patrick Connor, at Patrick M. Connor. Also, if you would please, and you're on Facebook, go to the Knuckles and Gloves Boxing Radio page there. Give it a like. Find us also on iTunes. Important. Thanks so much, Bryn. Talk to you soon, man.
Likewise. Take care, man.